Other thing is, if you have sent in your membership dues and information, thank you, thank you, thank you. We have lots of responses, and that is greatly appreciated. If you haven't sent in your information, Emily is going to put the link in the chat, which you would get to by clicking on that little bubble down at the bottom. And she will put the link in there for how you can respond as to your membership this year and your re-registration info. So that'll be there. And thank you very much for your continued support. And that's all I have. Back to you, Julia.
Thank you, Debbie. I think that we have our special guest with us. Dr. Garrett, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Great. So North Shore, I'm going to encourage you to make sure you have speaker view on. That'll make Dr. Garrett the largest feature on your screen. Let me just introduce him to you all tonight. Virginia native Marcus L.A. Garrett is an assistant professor of music and choral activities at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's an active conductor, and he served as guest conductor or clinician with all sorts of choirs throughout the country. He's also a fantastic singer. He performs both as a baritone and a countertenor. He's sung with all sorts of choirs and currently sings with the First Plymouth Congregational Church and the Festival Singers of Florida. He's also an avid composer of choral and solo vocal music. His compositions have been performed by all sorts of all-state, collegiate, professional choirs and are published by all the big publishers, GIA, Walton, Santa Barbara, Henshaw, Shermer, Karis Verlag, etc. As a researcher, his focus is the non-idiomatic choral music of Black composers. And we're super excited to have him here with us tonight to share some of his research with us and his love and his knowledge. I have found him to be an incredibly generous and kind colleague. And Dr. Garrett, this is the North Shore Choral Society. And if you, North Shore, if you go down to your reactions on the bottom, you can give him some applause already. It's super fun to do. So, yay! Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. It is an honor and pleasure to be with you tonight. I want to start off first by just saying I still remember when I met Dr. Davids. North Park University just happened to be on tour and Lincoln. I just was going through the stairwell and saw a flyer, and I was like, oh, there's another choir that's gonna be in town. Let me just go show up. Turns out it was a colleague's church who was hosting, and I was like, okay, cool. And sat there, and I was just like, why does this name sound so familiar? North Park, North Park, North Park. Ah, one of my mentors, Marvin Curtis, graduated from there, and he serves on the Board of Trustees, or I think it's what it is. And I've known him for 15 plus years now. And I still to this day talk, whenever I talk about the rule of punctuation, I talk about when their performance of James Erb's Shenandoah finally clicked, when I actually understood what the text was about, because they did not take the breath where everybody else does. And I was just like, this is great. I now know what this song is about. And so I got to meet her afterwards and then and met some students. I don't know if any of you know Olga, formerly Lebedeva. Okay. But Olga is a second year master student here, and everybody just loves her, and they're just like, who got her here? And I'm like, that's me. If I'm gonna take pride on anything, it's gonna be bringing her to this school. So I mean, we already have a little bit of a connection, and I look forward to the next time I get to be in the Chicago area, which, as long as things work out, will actually be at the end of February. We'll definitely chat about that. So I just want to start off by saying, as you heard, I'm Marcus. My pronouns are he, him, his, and feel free at any point if something doesn't seem right, you don't understand anything, please use the chat and, you know, put questions down there. I love comments. So I will let you know that I grew up in more Pentecostal Black churches. And if you've ever been to a Pentecostal church, it really doesn't matter what they look like. If you've been to a Pentecostal church, you know that things are very, very, very rarely quiet. There's always some reaction. Now, I understand that y'all are on mute right now, and that's totally fine. It's going to make things a lot easier for us. However, you can feel free to use the chat, to use your reactions. If there's something that you like, you're just like, oh my goodness, this is fantastic. Then let us know so that we can, you know, feel like we are in it together. Can I get a thumbs up that you'll at least try to do that? Yeah, great. Now, I want you to be thinking, even now, even though this is supposed to be like a presentation, I need your help. And there will be times when I will be asking some questions. So don't think that you could just sit here and be like, all right, I'm here. Let's just, how much longer is this guy gonna be? So I want you to be thinking about what things you can remember, because I'm gonna see how much you know. Yeah, we're getting ready. I already see Debbie got her hands ready. She's like, all right, I'm ready. Love it. Okay, so we're gonna start off with a few things. As Julia stated, my my research area is the non-idiomatic choral music of Black composers. And most of you in here are probably like, what the heck is all of that about? I did not know about this stuff until a few years ago, and I'll tell you all about that. So I just want to define a few terms just to make sure that we are all on the same page. So first, I think we're pretty clear on what music is. We know what composers are. We know what choral means, so I don't have to go through that. We're good. But let's talk about Black, the term Black. As of late, you know, some people are like, you know, I want to make sure that I say things correctly, that I do things right. I don't want to offend anybody, which is fantastic. I love every bit of that. You have the right heart. Unfortunately, in our attempts to be as inclusive as possible, we end up actually excluding a lot of people because we want to be politically correct. I use the term Black because it's an umbrella term that means anyone or anything that is of the African diaspora. You're like, well, diaspora? I haven't heard that word. Diaspora just means, you know, anything, a group of people that can be, that has been scattered, but can trace their roots to one area. So Black people can trace their roots to Africa, as pretty much all of us can. But that's a topic for another night. That's not why I'm here. So our Black composers, and I use that term because tonight you'll hear music from people who are not just African-American. And we will hear some music of African-Americans. And usually you hear that term, and there's nothing wrong generally with the use of African-American. The issue is when we look at someone and then we assume that because of this and our knowledge, which often is limited, as learned as we try to be, as educated as we want to be, as many books, we still don't know everything. And so let's say that, I mean, hey, y'all are in Chicago. Y'all have quite a few people, you know, pre-COVID and post-COVID. The airports are going to be a lot more full, and you'll have a lot more people coming from other places there. And let's say someone gets off the plane. The last time I was in Chicago, I was midway because I flew Southwest. So let's say that I hopped off the plane and I saw someone with skin very dark, like pretty much as dark as my hair. You know, I could assume that they're African-American, but they might have just gotten off a flight from Nigeria. So if they are born and raised in Nigeria and they are here on vacation, are they African American? Absolutely not. So this is why we have to, you know, it's all about getting to know people. You get to know people so you can figure out who they are instead of us trying to put that on them. That makes sense? Great, okay. So we've got the Black thing figured out, diaspora, and as someone I saw in the chat talk about Jews have a diaspora. I mean, everybody has a diaspora. You can talk about all those kinds of things. So now we need to talk about non-idiomatic. That tends to be very difficult. And some people are just like, well, I don't know what really idiomatic is. So in order to talk about non-idiomatic, we gotta get rid of the non and talk about idiomatic. Idiomatic, a simple definition from the dictionary, means the music or art that is related to a group of people or a place or an area. So if we're talking about Black composers, and we're talking about music, here is a time where I should see even more things in the chat. What are some genres that are generally associated with Black people? Okay, I see some things. Okay, lighten up. Yeah! Spirituals, gospel, soul, jazz, rap, Motown. Hip. Oh, man. I'll say out of all the folks that I've talked to, y'all have definitely already been the most active. This makes me happy. Yes, all of these and so many more are typically associated with Black composers. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Everything that y'all have put in that list are all great. They are all reputable contributions to music. Do I have a bias? Do I freaking love classical music? Absolutely. Am I going to poo-poo hip-hop? No, I may not use some of the words that they use, but I understand why they get it out. You know, a lot of it has to do with conversational language. And, you know, when we're home by ourselves with family and friends, I guarantee that every last person in on this Zoom call will drop, you know, an NG at the end every now and then. The prepositions may not always be in the right spot. Sometimes the verbs just disappear and that kind of stuff. It's just that some groups of people decided, I'm not going to try to put on an act just to record something. This is who I am. Just be okay with it. You understand what I'm saying? Sometimes, now I'm not gonna lie, some of that stuff, I'm like, huh? Can you repeat that? Slow that down a little bit. Let's work on the diction that we work on in choral music, then I can understand that a little better. But all of those styles, there's nothing inherently wrong with them. No music is better than another. So these Black genres are things that we're used to hearing. And especially with classical music, we are used to spirituals, gospel, and jazz. Those tend to be three of the more prominent ones. So what is non-idiomatic? It means anything that's outside of that. And for the most part, that is relegated to classical music. I could ask you, like, you know, I did a study when I was in graduate school, and I asked 15 graduates of historically Black colleges and 15 graduates of predominantly white institutions what their favorite three choir pieces were by a Black composer. And overwhelmingly, those who went to the PWI, they mentioned spirituals, gospel, and maybe some jazz. And those who graduated from historically Black colleges listed non-idiomatic. And I was like, whoa, this is something to unpack. And then I realized it's because the historically Black colleges, the predominantly Black orchestras, the Black professional choirs like the Hall Johnson Choir and the Eva Jesse Singers and the Brazil Denard Chorale and all those kinds of folks, Albert McNeil Singers, even Moses Hogan Chorale, they had been singing that kind of music, so they were used to it. That's what was always around them. And I, as a graduate of Hampton University, which is a historically Black college, we sang this all the time in our and all the choirs, really, but especially in our touring choir. And so having sung all of this music, in addition to singing, you know, Bach and Brahms and Bruckner and all of those folks like you're supposed to do, I then went to graduate school, a predominantly white institution, and I'm talking about Undine Smith Moore and R. Nathaniel Dead and Hall Johnson. These folks are like, who are you talking about? Adolphus, hell, what? Okay, I'm not familiar with any of this. And I remember showing a score of Adolphus Hale Storck's I Will Lift Up Mine Eyes to a colleague. And his cantata is, I mean, it's fantastic. Absolutely wonderful. And I'm just going through and I'm really excited about it. I'm just telling him about it. It's like 32 pages. So, you know, we got a lot of flipping to do. And so we get through all of them with a lot of the Theodore Presser scores with Hale Storck. They actually have his picture on the back. So then we get to the back page, and then my friend says, oh, I can't do this. I'm not, I don't know how to do gospel. I was like, dude, when did I ever say this was a gospel piece? Like, right, exactly. That should have been my face, Julia. But I mean, I did that in my head because I didn't want to scare him away. And then some other conversations that I had, I just realized that people just did not know that this music existed, even though almost all of the stuff that I had talked about in conversation was published. It just never got performed outside of those predominantly Black circles. I'm grateful now that so many people have asked have asked, where is this other music? And here we are. So I'm going to share my screen so that you can see a couple things. We're going to do quite a bit of listening because you really just need to experience this. But also, I am going to, before we get started, let me see if I can find these really quick. Yes, I am putting two documents. They'll upload quick in a little bit. Two documents in the chat. Also, if you're not able to download them, I've sent them to Julia, so you can get those from her. But the two documents that are there, one is just a straight up listening list. All you gotta do is click a link and you can go through that. And it is not just choral, but there are some art songs, a couple keyboard pieces, a lot of choir stuff, obviously. I mean, come on, who am I? And then some instrumental, like big instrumental, like wind band or symphonic music. So you can spend the rest of the year listening to all that, and it just scratches the surface. But then also, there's a choir, a vocal ensemble in over on the other side of the water, called Voices 8. Some of you may have heard them before. They're like really famous. Well, their tenor one, Blake Morgan, and I connected on Facebook back in June, was talking to him about this music, and he fell in love with it and went on the deepest of dives trying to learn all the stuff that he never experienced. And in the month of July, he dedicated each day to a Black composer. And he went chronological through his, he spent June like really researching, spent some of July as well. And then at the end, he created the handout that I shared with you that says Blake Choral, Black Choral Composer, something, something. And in that document, you'll get, it's a fact sheet essentially for the different composers, and then one or two pieces that you can listen to. And for those who like to also buy music, you can purchase pretty much all of those scores. So you got a lot of listening that you'll get to do. And hopefully this, our time together, these like next like 45 minutes or so, will inspire you to say, you know what? While we're not getting together, I can use a little bit of extra time and I can have some music playing in the background and be like, whoa, that's pretty great. Some more people need to know about it. And then you'll have conversations. You'll be like, you know, this really weird guy who's like moves his hands a lot on Zoom, he told me about this. And so I just want to share it with you. So hopefully that happens. All right. So now I can share my screen. Oh, first, you would think I would like have all of this Zoom stuff figured out by now, as many times as I've had to do it. But, you know, live and learn. Life happens. All right. Now go back to share. There we go. PowerPoint, computer, sound. There we go. Can you see it? Cool. So our first composer, now we just finished talking about some of our idiomatic styles. And remember I said spirituals, gospel, and jazz are the ones that are closest to the classical music, because more classical ensembles tend to do those styles. So there are some pieces that use spirituals or some other types of Black music, but they treat it very differently, very differently. So R. Nathaniel Dett, I'm gonna tell you right now, he's my favorite composer. I could talk about him for a long time, but I'm not going to. I will just mention the fact that he, throughout his life, dedicated a good chunk of his compositional career, especially his choral, the amount of time he spent on choral music, to preserving Black folk music. And he said that during his time, he noticed that there were people who tried to distance themselves from spirituals because it reminded them of slavery. And also some of them started going to churches that didn't really do spirituals. They had a lot of anthems and motets and hymns, and they wanted to hear some of that. So he was like, what can I do to make sure that we keep this gorgeous music that Antonin Dvorak said is one of the styles of music that is truly American, and American composers need to use it to create that American sound. What can I do? I'm not gonna be like my contemporary Harry T. Burley, who just like arranged spirituals. I'm gonna take the melodies. I'm gonna do something like Bach did and use these like in cantatas and the like. So his magnum opus is his oratorio called The Ordering of Moses. If you know anything about Moses in the Bible, then you know that he had to be called. He didn't want to do some things, and God had to be like, you know what? I'm telling you right now, this is what you need to do. So if you also think about spirituals, there are a few spirituals that deal directly with the Hebrew experience. And one of those spirituals is called Go Down Moses. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you all know that one, so I don't need to sing it. Det decided to use that spiritual to create this oratorio. It's about 45 minutes long, and you kind of hear little snippets of it, like even in the opening cello line. But before he had actually finished this work, and he was working on it in chunks, he wrote a letter to a friend and said, I think I have figured out what to do. There's something that I wrote a little while ago that I think will actually be, I can use with Go Down Moses. So he created a fugue on Go Down Moses. What? I'll tell you, I love fugues. Fugues are like the best thing ever to listen to sing, like I love them. But fugues in a minor mode, they get my heart really happy. I love spirituals. So if you create a fugue using a spiritual and in the minor mode, you won my heart. That's why this man is the greatest. Now that's my bias. My bias does not have to be yours. Some of you are like, Melissa Dunphy is amazing. J.S. Bach is fantastic. Mendelssohn, he was the cream of the crop. And you get to have your own opinion, but I'm the one talking tonight. So let's listen to the introduction into the fugue. You'll hear the basses, go down Moses, way down in Egypt. And then the tenors will take it a fifth higher like you're supposed to do with a fugue. But he's going to introduce it using his own text and like the picture you see up here. And from a burning bush, flaming, God spake unto Moses, saying what? Go down Moses. Let's have a listen. Okay, so I see some people did not get to hear all of that. So I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to try a second way. And if that second way doesn't work, then we'll go back to the original because I've got that in there. But hopefully you were able to hear some of that. Oh, it's amazing. We're going to go on to our next composer. His name is Adolphus Hailstork. And Dr. Hailstork, let's see, where do I need to start this one? I think it's about right. Yeah, there we go. Dr. Hailstork is in Virginia, and he is one of the most prolific composers that's living. Black, white, Latinx, doesn't matter. I mean, he has written so much music. And continuing on with like the use of spirituals or Black music, yes, that recording is on iTunes. And it's also, if you go, you can, it's on YouTube. And if you go to the handout that I sent, the listening list, all of the things that we're talking about, you, there's a link for that. So you can listen to the whole thing on your own. But this Done Made My Vow is an oratorio. Where it's based on the spiritual, Don made my vow to the Lord and I never will turn back. And he does that with the timpani at first, then there's a little canon. The section we're gonna listen to, it's a little lengthy, but I think it should mean something, hopefully it means something to you. He uses the familiar civil rights protest song, We Shall Overcome, which is actually for some people, for many people, they don't know, it was based on a spiritual called No More Auction Block. No more auction block for me. No more auction block for me. Many thousand gone. So then if you think about the fact that they use that as the inspiration for then We Shall Overcome, that's just like mind blowing to me. And it should probably give you a little, it gives it a different meaning, I think. But what he did with this is he takes the We Shall Overcome tune, and he starts off musically with the tenors and basses humming it. Then he transfers it to the sopranos and altos. And then after they're finished, the full choir is going to sing it. But that's not all that he did. And our focus tonight is on choral orchestral music. I forgot to mention that earlier. But that's not all that he did. He decided to not only add Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech in the original version, and you will hear Dr. Harold Carter, who was from Baltimore, as the narrator. He intersperses what I like to call a civil rights roll call. Why do I call it that? Because he had members of the choir are going to yell out or just say different civil rights leaders. And most of them, it'll be like last name, then first name, like you do in like homeroom and that kind of stuff. David, Juliet, here, you know, like Garrett, Marcus, here, or, you know, the one obnoxious kid is like present, you know, just let people know that they know big words. But anyway, I was that obnoxious one, just be very clear. But so you'll hear different civil rights leaders that are going to be spoken during this. So you got the I Have a Dream speech, you've got the roll call and the We Shall Overcome all happening together. Now, in a later version, I think it was maybe 5 years ago, he decided to update it, and you can actually replace the I Have a Dream speech with a speech by President Obama. And so it's whichever you want to do. I think I just listened to it only with the I Have a Dream speech, and so it just makes sense for me, but I'm not opposed to President Obama's speech. So I'm going to now, let me know if you, can you hear that?
Now is a time for remembrance. Is a time to honor those men and women who boldly declared themselves guilty before the bench of injustice, and by doing so, changed a nation. Thank you. Who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing. And of saying, power concedes nothing without a demand. If we ever get free from the oppressions and wrongs heaped upon us, we must pray for their removal. We must do this by labor, by sacrifices, and if needs be, by our lives.
Tyler!
Guilty of agitating, of demanding, of daring, of sacrificing.
Truth for justice.
Guilty of telling it like it was. Years.
Tubman. Harriet.
Guilty of escaping from slavery and returning like Moses to lead her people to freedom.
Du Bois.
Randall A. Bishop.
Guilty, double guilty, of organizing a union and of standing up to a president of these United States, forcing him to put blacks to work on the home front while he was sending them to kill and die on the battlefront.
Parks! Rosa!
Guilty of not moving to the back of the bus. Guilty of believing in a dream. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made straight and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside, let freedom ring." And if America is to be a great nation, this must come true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous peaks of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from the Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from the God Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and mole hill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. When we let freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free lives! Free lives! Thank God Almighty!
I don't know. Can y'all see the chills that I have right now? Like, I've listened to this piece for at least 13 years, and it never fails. I get so emotional. I mean, just all of that combined, I'm just like, wow, wow, wow. That is, whoo, yeah. Amazing, amazing. I love Hailstorm. All right, question time. Okay, got a few questions for you. So, name some of the civil rights leaders that were mentioned in Dunn Made My Vow. Now's the time for you to type. Yeah, love that y'all were paying attention. And if you watch the video that's associated with this, that's in that handout, you will actually see pictures of all of them when it gets to this. This starts at like the 16 minute mark. That's about where we started. And it ends at about 21 or 22. So you'll get to see all of it. It's fantastic. All right, good. Whose speech can be replaced, can be used to replace Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech? Yeah, and I saw somebody's sweatshirt. I don't know, I say Santa. Yeah, and I was like, oh yeah, Santa, okay, yeah. Let's see, two more questions. Who wrote the oratorio, The Ordering of Moses? You can just get the last name, fine with that. Yes. Oh, we're paying attention. Makes me feel like I'm doing something. Yes, and he's Canadian. Yes, born and raised in Drummondville, Ontario. But you know, Americans, I mean, you know, US citizens, we like to claim him too. But I always call him an Afro-Canadian composer. That's the way I always refer to him, which is why I use Black and not African-American. All right, and last question. Which spiritual did Det use to create the fugue for the Ordering of Moses? Hint, same last word. There we go, all right. So next up, we are going to move on to the woman who is referred to as the Dean of African-American Women Composers. Her name is Undine Smith Moore. Undine Smith Moore, I believe she was born in 1904 in Jarrett, Virginia. She taught for a number of years at Virginia State College. Now Virginia State University. One of my teachers was actually a choir director while she was there for some time. And she's written, like Hale Storch had written, in so many different styles. She's most famous for her arrangement of the spiritual Daniel, Servant of the Lord. But her original music is fantastic. And she wrote an oratorio, since we just finished talking about MLK, she actually wrote an oratorio called Scenes from the Life of a Martyr, where she actually wrote the text for it. And it's for, it has a soprano, alto, tenor, and bass solos in there and a narrator. And before different scenes in this, there's like a narration that's going to happen. I think there are like four of them. And she's just talking about the great work that Dr. King did. So now I mentioned the Dean of African American Women Composers, but we also have the Dean of African American Composers, just like the big dog. And that is William Grant Still. We're not gonna listen to his stuff, but he's got some pretty amazing things. So listen to his, like, I think I got on there and they lynched him on a tree, which is, whew, that's a heart-wrenching one. You just think about what the text is right there. Fun fact, a white woman wrote the text for that because he was married to a white woman, Verna Avery. Many people don't know that. But anyway, so Scenes from the Life of a Martyr, we're gonna listen to the Detroit Symphony performance of this from a few years ago with George Shirley, who taught at the University of Michigan for a number of years. He will be the narrator. And did you study with him? Oh!
I studied with Shirley Verrett at Michigan.
Oh, gotcha.
She was at Michigan when I was
there. Gotcha, okay, cool. Yeah, so George Shirley, you'll hear his voice speaking at the beginning of this. And we'll listen to two movements called They Tell Me Martin Is Dead. And so you'll hear the people are upset because this is after he has been shot. And so everybody, they finally heard the news. And so you'll hear all of that stuff in there. And then right after that is the movement called Tell All My Father's People, Don't You Grieve for Me. And there's an alleluia at the end of that. So let me pull that one up now. Is it? Yeah.
Know that love has chosen you to live his crucial purposes. Know that love has chosen you and will not pamper you nor spare. Demands obedience to all the rigorous laws of risk. Does not pamper, will not spare. Oh, master now love's instruments, complex and not for the fearful, simple and not for the foolish. Master now love's instruments,
I, who love you, tell you this. Even as the pitiful killer waits for me, I, who love you, tell you this.
And I'm going to stop that right there. But again, the link is in the handout that some of you have and some of you will get. A fun fact about Undine Smith Moore is that, and I got this from Carl Harris, because they were neighbors. Their offices were near each other. She would finish a piece and she'd always run down his office. Carl, I just finished a piece. And so he'd look at it and be like, okay, yeah. Okay, I look forward to doing it. And then he'd look at like usually like the last page and be like, don't you think a little bit of this is like too high for the sopranos? Well, if they are real sopranos, they should be able to sing a high B flat and a C. And he's like, all right. So that's why you hear that, ah, it's like really high. Cause she was like, if you're going to be a soprano, you better prove it tonight. Other than that, singing the alto section. All right. So pop quiz, who is the Dean of African American Women Composers? Yes, Undine Smith Moore. Now, I believe that Julia went to school with the granddaughter, Celeste Headlee, of the Dean of African American Composers. And who is that person? He got three names as well. Good old Bill. Oh, you know, oh. Yeah, William Grant Still. And Celeste Headlee has a fantastic TED Talk on how to have conversations. Yeah, check that out at some point. We listened to that in our conducting class. Very, very impactful. Who wrote the text for Scenes from the Life of a Martyr? who wrote that text? Anybody remember? She did. Yes, she did. And who is the protagonist of this story? Who is it all about? Yes, MLK. Great. We've heard a lot about him tonight. You know, he meant a lot to quite a few people. All right. So we've gone a little bit back in history. We had a living composer, Hale Storck, and then we've had deceased composers. We're going to go a little further back and jump down to Brazil. There's a gentleman by the name of José Maurício Nunes Garcia. And I'll show you a little picture of him real. Oh, no, that's going to start playing, and I don't want that. All right, let's see. Ba-da-ba-ba. Here we go. He was born and raised in Rio de Janeiro, and he is very still popular down in Brazil. If you search him on YouTube, you will probably hear a Brazilian choir and orchestra performing. He was a Catholic priest. And there was a little controversy about that because you had to be of pure blood. And he had a white parent, he was of a mulatto blood because both of his grandfathers were plantation owners. Both of his grandfathers were. And so he was not technically pure. Now, if you think back, and he was from the late 18th century, early 19th century. So if you know anything about Brazilian history or even Portuguese history, you know that there was a time when the king and queen of Portugal had to like escape and they came over to Brazil. They met this guy and was like, oh, wow, everybody loves him. Cool. Let's make him the first musician of the kingdom of Portugal. Yay. Everybody in Brazil was okay with that, but those musicians they brought over were like, nah, we don't like that. It only lasted for about 3 years before his contract did not get renewed. However, even though his contract didn't get renewed, he was the first composer to write an opera in Brazil. He also was the conductor who did the Brazilian premiere of Mozart's Requiem. Whoa, like this dude was important. Like he was very important. So I wanted you to see a picture of him. We're going to listen to, and almost all of his music has some sort of instrumentation to it. A lot of it has full orchestra. So we're going to listen to the Kyrie of the Mass of St. Cecilia. Most times when people say Mass of St. Cecilia, they're thinking Gounod. Well, guess what? There have been some others who have written masses for that wonderful person. Is this the one? Oops, wrong link. Hold on. Sorry. I didn't label these. I should have. All right. And we're going to listen to a good chunk of the Kyrie. And as we listen to this, I want you to think about the fact that he was writing music around the same time as Mozart and Haydn. And I pretty much hear Haydn in a lot of his music, even though he never met that person. All right, back to the sound.
Thank you.
And then they'll do a Kyrie after that. I like how Nicholas said that it sounds romantic. And that's one of the great things about music. We get to hear different things, and that's totally fine. But since you mentioned romantic, let's move to a romantic composer by the name of Samuel Coleridge Taylor. That was just the perfect segue. So thank you so much. Samuel Coleridge Taylor, I love that man's music. And maybe if I lived in like 1875 when he was born in Croydon, England, I might have been even say, I love this man. I mean, I feel like he and I would have been really good friends. Now he was, his mother knew that he had musical abilities from an early age, and she did everything she could to help him out. Here's the thing, even in England, racism was a thing. His dad was Black from Africa, from the continent, but he was a studied, learned, degree doctor. And sadly, because people didn't want to have a Black doctor, he couldn't get any patients. So he was like, in order for me to make money, let me go back to Africa. So he went back. His mother did, Coleridge Taylor's mother did everything she could. Rumor has it that like his an uncle kind of helped out with him getting some musical instruction. Well, he eventually made his way to a wonderful school where his primary composition teacher was none other than Charles Villiers Stanford. That it, I mean, that man was very famous, very famous. His three motets, if you don't know, Beati Quorum Via. I mean, it's just good writing. And he's got plenty of other great things as well, like The Bluebird, the lake lay blue below the blue, all that good stuff. Well, that was his teacher. One of his classmates was, you know, mostly unknown composer by the name of Ralph Vaughan Williams. You know, good old Ralphie. So no, he was not. That was sarcasm for those that didn't get that. Vaughan Williams, very famous. But that was one of his classmates. Stanford knew, he was like, this guy's got some stuff. Well, while he was in school, and yes, Ralph is spelled like Ralph. And I actually, a little aside, I remember somebody tried to correct me in school. It's pronounced Ralph. I was like, please go say that in public and see what happens to you. I'll sit back and wait. Anyway, so while he was in school, he wrote a work called Hiawatha's Wedding Feast. Yes, thank you, John Merchant. And it actually got published before it was premiered. And the conductor was Stanford. Standing room only. Everybody was waiting for this work. And he became instantly famous from that. Another work that helped him out was a violin concerto, a violin work that he wrote with orchestra that was for the Three Choirs Festival. And he got that gig because Edward Elgar was just too busy. He had too many commissions and he couldn't, oh my gosh, A Christmas Story. I'm so sorry. It's one of the best movies. So, okay, let me not look at that. Anyway, so Edward Elgar recommended Coleridge Taylor to write for that festival. So that went well. Hiawatha's Wedding Feast went well. And then he is asked to perform to write for everybody, to conduct everywhere. He came over to the US 3 times. Here's another interesting fact. Hiawatha's Wedding Feast was actually performed more times during Coleridge Taylor's life in a year, and every year was performed more times in England than Handel's Messiah. Right, I see all of these shocked looks, like what in the world? Exactly, I mean, we're talking easily 200 performances in like 1904. That's a pretty big deal, especially for somebody whose skin looked like this. That, I mean, it's great. So, yeah, we'll listen to a few minutes of that. Back to Elgar, though. Elgar, even though he recommended him after he started becoming famous, Coleridge Taylor, he then started bad-mouthing him, writing to all the music critics saying, well, he's only popular because he's writing the music that everybody likes to hear. I mean, is it? But why are you writing music unless you want people to actually perform it? They gotta like it to perform it. So it was crazy. So let's listen to a little bit of this. We'll start at the beginning, and you will probably hear in this music the fact that he really wrote a ton of his choral music for amateur singers. It doesn't diminish anything from it, but he was just like, I want to make sure that it's accessible so that everybody feels like they can be a part. And I mean, even Robert Shaw talked about the fact that the heart of choirs, the heart of choir lies with the amateur or volunteer singers. And I fully support that. All right, I'm going to share my screen because you we'll be able to see like really tiny, but you'll be able to see some of the full score for this. And there's a picture of him. So that's all of our listening for tonight. No, I don't think there are any high C's for any of the sopranos. So sorry. But hey, I will say this. He was born in 1875, which means that in less than 5 years, we will start the sesquicentennial celebration of the birth of Samuel Coleridge Taylor. This is definitely one. I'm talking to everybody about this. Like 2025, we just need to start planning for it in 2022, 2023. I see you're writing down. Yes. And there are so many other fantastic works. If you got any pianist friends, he wrote a suite called 24 Negro Melodies, where he takes 12 tunes by from like the islands and from Africa, and then 12 spirituals, and creates individual pieces for that. He's got a number of other choral orchestral works. Now this the cantata that we just listened to is like a 31-32 minute work, which has one of the best tenor arias you could ever here on Away Awake Beloved. It's gorgeous. But that is actually, it was written by itself. And then he was commissioned, and he loved Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. So that's the text that he used. Well, he then used portions of the rest of that epic poem, The Song of Hiawatha, and wrote two more cantatas. Didn't do so well, but I mean, some people have done them. And he also wrote an overture, which is not to be performed at the beginning. He was very intentional about that. He wanted it as the third movement of this long work. And there's an actual video on YouTube of just the audio. You can hear all four big sections. So two cantatas, the overture, and then the final cantata. But Hiawatha's Wedding Feast is definitely the best one. You can listen to that tonight. I see Sharon has played some of his organ music. I haven't heard any of his organ music. That is pretty good. So maybe somebody can send me a recording of one of those pieces. So I do want to make, just give an honorable mention, even though we're not going to listen to it tonight. But if you have not heard of the composer Joel Thompson, he's on the East Coast, and he wrote a work called The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. If you see his name, most people say Joel, J-O-E-L, but it's actually pronounced Joel. Joel Thompson, The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. And the premiere was by the University of Michigan Men's Glee Club under Eugene Rogers. And what he did was he used the last words of seven Black and brown people who had been killed by police. Well, my friend Ariel Marival, who is actually here in Lincoln at First Plymouth Church, he actually was part of the little pickup choir that Joel pulled together of men that said, hey, I just wanted to write this thing. So can y'all just like sing it so I can hear it? And so that's what happened. Ariel knew Eugene Rogers and said, dude, there's this like amazing piece that you need to listen to. So he sent them the score. Eugene was like, okay, whatever. He listened to it and was like, I don't really care. Ariel's like, look, dude, take another look at it. He did that. And then it just like went off the charts. And so that's actually also on the list. The second movement, which I believe is the Trayvon Martin movement, actually uses a fugue, because if you know anything about what happened, you know, Trayvon Martin was running from George Zimmerman. And so when you think about fugue, flight, and that kind of stuff, I was like, whoa, that is mind blowing. And then the next movement was the first one that was transcribed for mixed choir called Mom, I'm Going to College. And another heart, like you will get goosebumps. For those that don't know, Armando, he was, I mean, the last thing that he said to his mom, like he was on the phone and said, Mom, I'm going to college. And then he got killed. And so it's a very simple setting of that, but it is absolutely beautiful. And I kind of hate using that with this type of work because it's all about people who died. So that is Joel Thompson's The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. And again, that's going to be on that list, the listening list that I sent you. So you'll check those things out. All right. So final thoughts from me and then questions from you. And I'll scroll back up because I think there are some questions that I didn't get a chance to answer in the chat. Hopefully through all of this, you have been like, there are some things that I did not know ever existed. And so no matter how long you have been doing something, you should always be trying to seek out new things. Never trying to put anybody or anything in a box. Because so many times Black composers, Black musicians in general have been placed in these musical boxes. How do I know this? Well, when I was teaching at a historically Black college up in Pennsylvania, we went on tour and we were in North Carolina at a church where I had sung for a semester. And I was all Black students. We're in tuxedos and gowns. And I'm talking to one of my students outside of the church. And a woman comes up. She's like, oh, I'm so looking forward to tonight's concert, the Cheney University Concert Choir. And I'm like, oh, I'm glad that you're here. Hopefully you enjoy. She's like, can't wait to hear some of that rousing gospel music. And I was like, ma'am, what part of tuxedos and gowns and concert choir makes you think that we're going to do gospel music? And I realized it's because she just looked at a picture of Black people and said that's what she's going to hear. Did we have gospel music in our rep? Yes, we only had one piece. But I said, I was this close to not doing it because I wanted to show her up. to be like, you know, we're going to, you know, exceed your expectations. Not that there's anything wrong, again, with doing gospel music. But then I decided, you know what, she probably only heard it at her white Episcopal church if she's heard some gospel music, and they probably weren't doing it right. So let's let her hear how it's supposed to be done. So we did it. And I wish I could have seen her afterwards to see, you know, what her reaction was and everything. But these are, that's just one small example. I can mention Reggie Mobley, who is he's a countertenor. He's sung all over everywhere. And he talks about the fact that there have been multiple times when he's getting ready for a recital or a performance where he might be walking through the lobby. And he vividly remembers one time where somebody asked him to unlock a door because they needed to get into like a closet or something. They assumed that he was a janitor. Another person was like, oh, they wrote a review and just said, you know, you see this large black man who you think is going to be a linebacker walk on stage, and then he opens his mouth and this beautiful countertenor voice comes out. Why do you have to mention linebacker? These are some of the, as he calls them, microaggressions that a lot of black musicians have to deal with all the time. So we, everybody in this room, myself included, all 73 of us have a responsibility to make sure that in music and outside of it, that we're not putting people in boxes. Thinking about having a different perspective on all kinds of things. So looking at somebody saying, I could probably assume based on stereotypes, and I probably will end up being right, but what are some other things that this person might be able to do? What do I think this music could sound like without having ever heard it? Those kinds of things. And I'll say, don't be discouraged. You don't know what you don't know. That's one of the best things I ever learned. You don't know what you don't know. And so I, as a black man, when I'm having conversations with people, I have no problems with people asking me questions about things so that they can get the truth, whatever that truth is for me, based on my experiences or my research, those kinds of things. And so just don't be scared to seek out new things and all this kind of stuff. Again, you've got a lot of music that you get to listen to. You got those two handouts, so you should be having fun. And I didn't choose anything that was going to bore you. I chose some of the most exciting things. I mean, there are a few pieces that you'd be like, okay, when's the next one? All right, but hopefully all of those are some that are like will keep your attention. All right, I could ask some more questions, but now is the time for you to ask questions. If you want to go ahead and type some in, that will be fine. I did see, y'all are really active tonight. I love it, which means I've got a lot of scrolling to do. Somebody talked about Olga. Oh, yes, absolutely wonderful. That was that. Oh, all the idiomatic genres of black music we provided are mostly American. Since black is larger than African American, are there other categories from outside of North America that would be considered part of the black idiomatic universe? Absolutely. Do I have an answer for what those are outside of like folk music? No. I just haven't had the time to check those out. And honestly, what I didn't say, oh, I totally forgot. So glad I still have your attention. When I first started talking about this topic in conversation when I was at Florida State, one of my classmates, Alex Favaza, who's up in New Hampshire, was like, you know, I think what you're talking about is non-idiomatic. So he's actually the one who gave me that, because I would, instead of just saying like original choral music or whatever, you know, just trying to make it sound more academic, I was like, you know what, if I say non-idiomatic, enough people will be like, I don't know what that means. It'll make me seem smart if I give like a definition. So I'm gonna use that, but I always credit Dr. Favaza. I usually credit at the beginning, but I'm glad I didn't forget down here. So yes, most of them have, that we talked about, were definitely American ones. But statistically speaking, when it comes to black composers, most of the composers that we think of and have studied and really know are from America, even though there are some African ones, and some of them are actually in Blake's handout. Somebody loves Florence Price. Yeah. And G. Shermer now owns the rights to Florence Price, and so they're actually typesetting a lot of her manuscripts, so pieces that have never been out before. Art songs, piano works, violin, orchestral, you name it, they're doing that. All right, I think I got all those. Let's go down. Ten. Which word needs to come first, Black or non-idiomatic? I don't know. Black, non-idiomatic, non-idiomatic, Black. I think it'll probably be better if you separate them and use like non-idiomatic something music of Black composers that or Black musicians. That will probably be easier than trying to put the two together. I've never said it together, so that's why I had to think about it. I always give it as qualifiers. Yeah.
Could I ask you a quick question on behalf of all of us? I think we hear the term appropriation a lot or misappropriation better, because appropriating just means borrowing, essentially, not necessarily in a power dynamic or a poor way. So I think what many of us think about is it okay for me as a white Canadian girl to be conducting spirituals or even non-idiomatic repertoire by Black composers?
Yeah, so I can talk about that from a few different vantage points. We'll talk about the non-idiomatic. One of the great things about it is that that music really just falls into the same categories as all of the other classical music that we hear of Fanny Mendelssohn or Debussy or Fauré or Bortnianski or Tchaikovsky. I mean, all of those folks, it's just that same music. And you could do side-by-side comparisons, like some of Nunes Garcia's works with Haydn, or putting some of Elgar and Stanford's music alongside Coleridge Taylor. So if you wanna be the safest, I say stick to the non-idiomatic. You do have some pieces like William Grant Still's And They Lynched Him on a Tree, which can be a little intense. And I had a student, when we talked about it 2 years ago, he was like, well, can I as a white conductor conduct that, because it's about a Black person being lynched? Now that William Grant Still actually asked that you have a separate Black choir and a separate white choir, because it's supposed to be about them talking and responding to each other, but then at the end they come together. But like I said, his wife, who wrote the text, was white. The man who conducted the premiere of that was also white. I guarantee they probably had a bunch of white folks in the orchestra. So there is absolutely nothing wrong with anybody from any culture doing that. Now, when it comes to the more cultural music, it does get a little weird. I'll talk about spirituals because that tends to be the one that comes up the most. Like, I'm white, so I can't do spirituals. The spirituals come from Black people. Guess what? Just because it came from Black culture does not mean that anybody owns it. Let's start there. Because just because my ancestors created something doesn't mean that I have the rights to it. Like, they didn't even say that they had the right to that music. They were just singing stuff. Should you honor them? Absolutely. Should you talk about the history of slavery, American slavery, with the enslaved Africans and everything that they went through in order to give an accurate description of how this music came to be? I'm 100% in support of that. When it comes to performing the arrangements, I tell everybody, when you look at the scores, and the earliest spiritual arrangement for choir was Harry T. Burley's Deep River in 1914. Now, I've looked at that score, I've looked at some of his contemporaries like Hall Johnson and the like, and I've not been able to find anything on there that's like a little asterisk that says, you know, see the note below or the note on the front cover that says only to be performed by Black people. It doesn't say that. Guess what? They were getting the music published by white people. They wanted that music to be out. So why do we 100 years later get to say, oh, well, you can't sing that music? You have nothing to do with this. You didn't collect it from the field. You didn't arrange it. You didn't release it. None of that kind of stuff. Do the music. I mean, some people then say, well, should you say it's a spiritual, traditional spiritual, African-American spiritual, Negro spiritual? My personal opinion is to use Negro, because one, it helps to remind us of slavery, to remind us of where this music came from. I am opposed to the term African-American because the people who created this were not American. They were enslaved Africans. They were not considered people They were property when they were over here. And we do not, in the 21st century, get to retroactively grant citizenship to people in order to then be politically correct and say African-American spirituals. Now, I will say, I have African-American friends, Black friends, who disagree with me and say Negro is an antiquated term. They get to have their opinion. I feel like my opinion is rooted in history and facts, and theirs is based on opinion, but that's just me. That's just me. But again, you get to do the music. Be as true to the style as possible. There's no such thing as authentic performances of spiritual arrangements, because the spirituals were created in the field, and the moment we put it on paper and then performed it on stage, it is no longer authentic, even with a group of Black people. Some of you are like, that's not what everybody else has said. Well, that's the honest truth. Now, if you were trying to do it the way they did it in the field, then we could talk about authentic, and we can go back and read some of the texts that have been written about how the music was performed in the fields and that kind of stuff. But once you start adding all of this polyphony, like William Dawson did, and like Ezekiel Saw the Wheel and Ain't It That Good News, adding all these extra syncopations and 14 parts and that kind of stuff, I'm sorry, that it's no longer authentic. It is very far removed. All we did was keep up some of the text and some of the notes, because especially now in the 21st century, everybody's just changing it up, and you don't even get to hear the melodies that like they originally were, but all that kind of stuff. I saw a question about Gullah music. I have not studied Gullah music, but Derek Fox, I believe, who's at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, he has studied a little bit of that, and also like shape note singing. If you don't know about shape note singing, yeah, just go listen. Oh, that's some of the best stuff. You get a church lining out a hymn. Oh man, that's good, good stuff. All right, let's see. That was a question about appropriation. All right, any other questions for me? Yes, this was recorded.
Yes.
I see the recording button and it's like flashing. So, yes. You sent me an email about that. So it'll be available for anybody. I don't care who sees this.
I told him we weren't going to widely release it on YouTube or anything. But I wanted it to have it for especially our members who weren't able to be here tonight, but also share with my students at North Park and others. This has been like the funnest Tuesday night I've had in a long time. And we have a lot of fun on Tuesday nights. So thank you so much for enriching our evening and especially just giving us so much to think about. There's a lot of sadness right now for us singers who don't get to sing together. So it's amazing to have this opportunity. And I will admit that Dr. Garrett was one of the first people I went to like way back in May and June. It was like, oh, I want you to come and talk to us,
really,
because this is something North Shore is very passionate about and excited.
I see that a couple people have asked the same question, countertenor and baritone. Okay, so I need to take that countertenor part out of my bio, because you're the second one this week that has mentioned, you know, and yeah, it's in the bio, but that was because somebody told me to put it there, because I really wanted to talk about the fact that I got to sing the alto for the European premiere of Danforth's Jubilate Deo. And so, I mean, the easiest way was just to say countertenor, but now people keep talking about that. And I don't want people to think that I'm like really trying to pump myself as a countertenor. Like, I mean, I'll sing some stuff every now and then, but how do I sing all of the parts? I think that was another question. That's just years of experience. Like when I first got my license and I was listening to gospel music in the car all the time, I wanted to sing soprano, alto, and tenor. So I sang all of those parts. And then when you teach gospel music, the best way, the most authentic way to teach it is teaching it by rote, not with a score. And so I've gotten used to doing that. And so, yeah, that's where a lot of that, yeah, that comes from. So.
And most countertenors are truly baritones.
Most of them are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we need to all come off mute and give Dr. Garrett a real like North Shore cheer and thank you. And just thank you so much for spending your evening with us.
Thank you. Woo!
Thank you so much.
Fabulous.
Thank you so so much. And North Shore, I will see you next Tuesday. Dr. Garrett, I'll be following up. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, everyone. This was wonderful. Have a great night.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Dr.
Garrett.
Bye.
Thank you.
Oh, awesome. 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 Awesome job.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you, Julia. Thank you so much.
Take it easy, everybody. Stay safe.
Bye-bye.